You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on. Good morning, near and far. Welcome to the 3CR Gardening Show on this very fine February morning. Back on field after being benched last week is Chloe Foster. And I do hope every listener has had a safe and restful summer so far, wherever you may be and whenever you may be tuning in. Joining me today for some plant and no doubt soil chat is Jane Tonkin of Tonkin Bulbs and Perennials.
Good morning, Chloe.
Good morning, Janie. Russell Lark, head gardener at the Test Garden within the MAPCO precinct.
Good morning, Chloe, and listeners.
And Peter May, soil expert and former lecturer at Burnley Gardens. Hello.
Hi, Chloe, and everybody else.
Welcome to the show, everyone. We got here. There's a big festival going on in Smith Street this morning, which we didn't know about.
Parking was a bit rough.
Yeah, it was.
So not only is the Eastern closed,
I
get here and then Smith Street's closed. And I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, nice to go for a walk this morning.
It was a beautiful morning and sunrise was so pretty.
It was lovely.
Nice and pink and cute clouds and it was really nice.
Just hanging out for the rain that the Bureau thought we might get, but you never know.
You never know. New South Wales and further north from Melbourne looks like they're definitely going to get some and it's gone through.
Last night I was, geeking out on the radar and watching Deniliquin get completely sort of saturated. So, but whether it's going to get as far south as us, we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah,
fingers crossed. While we're on the topic of weather, Pete, you keep some very judicious rainfall records at your property, don't you?
I do. We've been living up there since the start of 1983. So this is in Kyneton in central Victoria, the southern edge of Dja Dja Wurrung country. And I started keeping rainfall records when we moved up there. So I've got, 43 odd years of rainfall data, which,
if
you're looking for qualification for geekness, then...
Well, I mean, the next step up is, have you been crunching the numbers?
Oh, yeah, I do that from time to time, So
what patterns are you getting?
Well, given that radio is such a visual medium, I was playing with numbers leading up to this session because people have been saying, this is the hottest summer, the driest summer, and I'm not convinced that either of those things are true. But it obviously also depends a hell of a lot on where you are. So I can talk about with some confidence about where I am, but what's happening to other people is less clear to me.
Yep.
But looking at this year and last year and the summer, as at the end of January, this year is basically the same as last year. Now, what happened last year, though, was that we then got effectively no rain until the start of June. And I don't know whether that's going to happen this year or not, and you never do. Mm. So the garden, my garden at the moment, is looking pretty stressed. But it's not because I think this has been a particularly awful summer, but rather it's a consequence of last year's summer.
Mm.
There was, I think, no recharge of deep soil water reserves. And so we got some lovely rain in November, but when that was gone, it was all over. And it's going to be fingernail stuff for the rest of the rest of the year. And I should, and in my garden in particular, I should qualify that by saying that this garden's about 10 years old, and I went I went fairly hardcore with it when I set it up, and the plan was, and I've been true to that thus far, that I would never water it, and I haven't.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it is what you get. What you see is what you get, pretty much.
So even if we, you know, during, you know, a summer dry spell and coming up to some 40-degree days, it must be really hard to hold yourself back just to go, no, I won't pull out the hose. Like, well, I won't just pull out the hose and give it a...
That's tough love, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And yeah. It's there are days when I think, gee, I wouldn't mind getting out there and giving it a really thorough soak. But I've been strong so far.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And the garden's... the garden's basically pretty good. Yeah. I mean, I had a couple of things last year that said goodbye at the end of... By the end of winter, they'd had enough, and they'd been there for 10 years, and they thought, well, you know, there were some big balls of Berberis. What's the purple one?
Thunbergii
atropurpurea. Had three of those, and they just didn't come back in the spring.
Wow.
And they were 10 years old, so I've now. But on the plus side, I've now got a gap that I can think about putting new stuff into.
That's exciting.
So, you know, that's all good.
What about when the garden? Sorry, Russ. When the garden was initially planted, did you water it till it was established?
I planted everything in the winter.
Yep.
And honestly, I can't remember. This year, I did a bit of gap filling, and some of those things I've had to water because they went in. Late winter, early spring, and it was really dry. And I thought, well, if I don't do that, these aren't going to come through the winter. But that's been individual, that plant, rather than soaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to be true to my principles.
Yeah.
it's an interesting thing because once, I mean, I'd been practicing killing plants for about 30, 30 years before this garden, so I had a pretty good idea of what.
Yeah.
Wouldn't survive,
This is the wrong show, I think.
Sorry,
I'm so emotionally attached to my babies. I'm like, oh, yeah, have a drink, baby. I don't, yeah, are you feeling okay?
We have to get past this.
You guys need to hang out a bit more.
Yeah. The nice thing about it, and I'll stop preaching about this in a second, but the nice thing about it is that I don't have to worry about them.
Oh, that would be so nice that they're not worrying.
No, it is what it is.
Mm. And,
you know, it's that Ned Kelly such is life thing. You just, we'll wait and see. And every year's a learning experience because they're never the same.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think interestingly too, the projections, at least, you know, around Melbourne are going to be drier winters.
Yes.
So you're not going to get that recharge of soil and then you're going to get these kind of concentrated dumps
in
summer. So that's really going to change how, especially in large-scale landscapes and public landscapes, how you irrigate and that sort of stuff, you know. Yep. There'll be some thought to, you know, adding supplementary watering, certainly before spring, because that bridging season is a challenge, you know, for establishment of any garden when it starts to warm up and that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. I did a study when I left Burnley, which was now 20 years ago. I ran a consulting business for a while, and which is when you and I would have met each other at Cranbourne. And I did a study for the City of Melbourne. This was getting towards the end of the Millennium Drought, and they'd been doing things like putting ploughing and drip lines into parkland to look after trees, and they wanted to get some feedback on what that was doing and whether it was effective and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And, for anybody who's interested, this all got written up in a paper and I can give you the reference. But one of the recommendations that came out of that from me was that they had these drip line irrigation systems, and when they – and at that stage we were looking at the Millennium Drought being an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
That – they should be irrigating in winter.
Mm. To recharge the soil.
To recharge the soil.
Yeah.
And rather than turning on the irrigation system in, say, November, at which point you're forever just chasing your tail.
Yeah, yeah.
You physically can't put enough.
You can barely keep up with the transpiration, can you? Especially bigger things, big shrubs and trees and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So irrigate in winter because it's more like it's going to be more effective.
Yes.
Over the drier months.
You actually get the...
Into the soil, rather
than the water just simply being, you know, the roots are outside the drip line and they're just pumping the water straight out, whereas you irrigate in the wintertime and the water's not being transpired as anywhere near as quickly, and you actually get some soil wetting going on.
Mm.
Now, the millennium drought then broke, and I don't think that practice ever happened, but in the event that we did get these dry winters coming in, that's the logical time to be pumping the water on.
Yep.
So that you go into summer with a wet profile.
That's so cool.
The other thing you do is you by doing that you can promote deeper root growth. Obviously you don't want to saturate anything.
Yeah.
But when you're just irrigating to keep up with transpiration rates, the roots aren't really exploring the depths of those soils, you know. So interestingly, Cranny, you know, you would at Cranbourne Botanic Gardens, it's on sands. Like we would find old, you know, 35-year-old mallees that had roots to 3 metres in the soil, like that builds resilience, for those plants. So
I think that a lot of established trees do have at least some of their root systems at some depth.
Yeah.
I mean, I noticed in my garden, again, going back to that hoary chestnut, but I've got a Chinese pistachio that I planted probably about 5 years ago, and it last week it actually put on a flush of new growth.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got roots somewhere.
Yeah, it's found something.
It's not stressed.
Yeah, it's not stressed. And my next door neighbours don't water their backyard either, so it's not sort of stealing water out of their garden.
Yeah,
it is operating purely on what's there.
So, yeah.
That's really interesting. Thanks, Pete.
I mean, there's so much we don't know about these things. Where are roots and where do plants get their water from? Mm. Where an individual plant gets its water from? Lots of questions we don't really have clear ideas about.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that's easy to study. Just
very difficult
looking into a root system. That's still alive.
And there's a lot of fungi and bacteria doing their thing down there as well. You know, helping with plant resilience and that sort of stuff, which is unexplored for the most part.
So, Russ, jumping back over to the test garden where you've got 30 centimetres, if that.
Slightly different story.
It's a slightly different story. How's the test garden going at the
moment? Look, it copped it on the 40-degree days. Yeah. I was saying to Jane before I was in Bali, so luckily I missed that and came back. And Nat, who's now Natalie Simmons, who is now employed at MAPCO to help with the gardens, she had to endure the pain of those 40-degree days. So I was in a pool at the time. So,
mention that one more time.
That was a 5-star resort too, Chloe, which is great. We're asking plants to do a lot in the test garden because it is, 200 to probably 350 at the very most. And historically, at that depth in the Burnley kind of rooftop substrate, you're using succulents and grasses and that sort of stuff. So we're asking our plants to do a lot, especially some of the like exotic perennials and that sort of stuff. So it's little and often, because it is so shallow. If you over irrigate, you can lose a fair bit of it. Mm. I think the key at this time is it does get so hot. So if you put your hand on the scoria when it's 40 degrees, like that is, it really does. I reckon it's 80, 90 degrees. It's so hot. And it's surrounded, like for anyone who knows the test garden, like it's surrounded by hard landscape. So it's even hotter. And there's no shade or anything like that. So, yeah, we've been babying our little babies at the moment. This is part of the reason it's a test garden, to understand how we can keep this suite of species alive. And also at times you have to make decisions, and we're going to have to make more about which species can kind of survive at that depth. Like we're going to have deeper substrate in the Luckbundup garden, the big one, so it'll be a bit less stressful. But sometimes you've got to make a call if things, can't deal with that. The flip side of having 200-300 mil is in winter and it's really wet.
Mm.
So what happens, we're just chatting about that bridging season, is the roots kind of die off because it's saturated down the bottom, and they don't have a lot of root mass to cope with that. You know, as soon as it gets warm in the spring and they start transpiring again, you actually have to irrigate quite a lot at the beginning, but not too much so they can throw their roots down a little bit. So it's just this balancing act all the time.
You'd have to be looking at it on a daily basis almost.
Oh, you do. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But it's fun. We're learning heaps.
Yeah, you would be.
Yeah, and it looks great. Like we had an open day there yesterday. Like a Meet the Gardener event.
I saw you on social media.
He's always on social media.
I'm really trying. I got a pep talk from you, Chloe, and Emmeline Bowman, another 3CR stalwart, about upping my social media game. So I'm trying, you know.
Yeah,
follow me. If you're listening, no, I'm joking.
Do you want to give your app?
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Russell in the Leaves.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, who came up with that one?
That's quality.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that sort of 25 to 30 centimetre depth, because a lot of our stuff we have to grow in containers or pots and things due to my wildlife. So it is that constant day-to-day sort of moisture check of, does this need watering, does that need watering?
Yeah.
And I get what Peter says about, you know, it would be so fabulous to have this thing that I didn't have to water, but when you grow exotics and...
Oh, it's a completely different scenario, Jane. Don't feel guilty. Don't justify yourself.
But I kind of... I've had a really bad summer because we have a dam that's high enough on the property that gravity feeds all our greenhouses. Now, there's 14 or 15, I've lost count, some, you know, 60-foot-long greenhouses that I have to water. And that dam runs off a spring which has dried up, and it did the same thing last year but didn't do that till early March.
Oh.
And so I went to turn a tap on last March. It was the weekend of the Fernie Creek plant show. I went to turn some taps on to water before we went to the fair. No water.
Mm. Oh,
so we do have a dam
that's happened earlier.
The next one down, but you have to have a physical pump there. And so when I want to go and turn a greenhouse on or a hose on, I have to go and start a pump. So this whole week of Kirill and I sort of going, well, we can't do this all summer. This is, it's not going to be feasible. You know, the threat of bushfire, and you've got this petrol pump that's sitting in the middle of the bush already, that if you need water and something happens, I can't defend anything. So we've now come up with this solution of, so from the next dam down, we've got an old piston pump that is working, and Kirill and I go up twice a day and put a stick in the edge of the dam of how far it's risen. See, this is the kind of boring stuff that we do.
Yeah.
But
Take a step back. Tell me what a piston pump is. I don't know.
So it just does its thing. Like every time the piston sort of drops, whatever, it goes kaplunk.
Right.
Like those.
Like
a pneumatic one in but different. But this one's electric. And of course we're off grid, so when my brother told me that this will work, Jane, this will work, and it'll push water back up the hill, and you know, because he's super smart. And so we buy this pump, and I said, so how many watts does it take? Because how often is my generator going to run to top up batteries and things? And anyway, see, I'm complaining. I'm actually venting, everyone. So go make yourself a cup of tea while I vent.
Yeah.
So
Pete, Russ, do you want to get a cup of?
Yeah, I might actually. Yeah. Thanks. Good luck with it all.
Yeah.
So it's been a horrible time, that sort of this whole week of, you know, even our firefighting is a pump that runs off the PTO of a tractor. So the tractor sits down by the dam under a sprinkler. All that comes up to the shed, and like Chloe's been, and big sprinklers and things. And on that Friday of the really sort of dodgy day, I went to start the pump and just maybe wet everything down for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And, of course, the belts that run the two pulleys between the tractor and the pump needed new ones.
Oh, no.
And, of course, what was it? A long weekend.
Oh, Jane.
So I said to Mum, you know, I can't defend the house. I can't do this. It's not going to work and whatever. So, yeah, anyway, my stress levels have been a little bit high and... yeah, if it wasn't for Kirill, I'd probably still be fetaling on the floor of the shed right now. But, you know.
Yeah, I'm a real panicker in those situations. I'm just, yeah.
I just, and I need to be able to have water to keep stuff alive. And it almost got to, well, it did get to this stage of which ones can I lose?
Yeah.
And which ones are more important to me?
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad, but anyway. I'm still here. Quite.
Yeah,
it's all good. Okay, enough venting.
It's
sorry.
Been a bit full on.
Yeah.
And the wallabies just trying to keep eating all your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you're using heap of water on it. So great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
all
just
the challenges.
Well, I mean, at least they've got moisture and... The deer are still making a mess at the edge of the dam.
Oh, that's, dear.
You know, yeah.
Good one, Russ. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Yep. Listeners, if you haven't
tuned
out yet.
He is a dad. It's just, you know, yeah.
Some of my finest work.
Yeah. If there's anyone still listening. Yeah. This is the 3CR Gardening Show. I'm Chloe Foster. With me today is Jane Tonkin, Russell Lark and Peter May. If you want to join the chat, the lines are open 94190155. The text line is 0488 809 855. We are on social media on Facebook and Instagram, where we pop up guest announcements for the week and images of the plants that we chat about on each show, and it's the 3CR Gardening Show handle for both of those. I can't take text messages on the during the show, so if you want to send us a photo, the best way to do that is via email, and that is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And hello to any podcast listeners out there. That's the best way to contact us as well, via the email. So thank you very much. We did have a very organised listener who has messaged in the show well before we got here this morning. Cheryl in Bitten says her peonies haven't died down yet. She wonders if it's normal and if there's anything she should be doing. I'm going to throw it straight to you, Jane Tonkin.
I was going to throw it to Russ. Good morning, Cheryl. The fact that your peonies haven't died down yet is a really good thing. The longer they stay green, the better. So kind of a little bit jealous because mine look all brown and yellow and wallaby eaten. So you're doing everything right. You could actually give it a liquid feed now if you wanted to. You should be fertilising peonies twice a year. We generally say Anzac Day and then Cup Day. Just because people remember those, and adding sort of the good organic ones, not sort of going with names, but something like a dynamic lifter, that kind of thing, is always good in the autumn to sort of get, because they put on those beautiful new roots during the winter when they can actually get down into that moisture and stuff too, and a bit of garden lime or dolomite. So everything right. Don't stress. It'll do its thing when it's ready.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you very much, Jane. We had a caller, but they've gone. So there was a caller that just got a note here. Frank from Noble Park has 7 olive trees and wants to know what he can do with his olives. That's the first question.
Should brine them.
Yeah, just a salt brine.
Yeah.
The ratios, I'd be jumping on the internet for the ratios.
Yeah.
I don't know them.
There's lots of recipes, different ways of tackling it. The simplest thing to do is just layer them in salt.
Ah.
And that sucks the water and bitterness out. It takes a while. I think I had a batch that had been in salt for 2 years.
Really?
And they come out like little hard pebbles, but you then rehydrate them in, I used red wine.
Oh, Pete, did you bring any in?
not on the olives, mind you.
And they rehydrate.
Yeah.
But there's a whole lot of others. I came across a book a couple of years ago. The title escapes me, written by a Melbourne doctor whose family are Italian, and I think it's called something like Italian Food Preserving or something like that. Mm. Great little book, and it's got about half a dozen olive recipes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Different ways of approaching the thing. But generally, yeah, you're right, Russell. You start with salt.
Yeah.
Either dry salt or in brine.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've got a couple of nephews who do it every year, and they they prepare their olives and then they sell them for a cause, which is really cute. Like WWF or whatever, ACF. Yeah. Which is pretty cute.
So the World Wrestling Federation.
World Wildlife Fund.
Oh, that
I mean, I'm sure wrestlers need money as well.
Yeah, they need support.
Yeah, shout out to all the wrestlers out there listening to the gardening show.
Nice. All right, the other question that Pia has just put up for us is, Frank from Noble Park as well, wants to know what time of day and how long should you leave your sprinklers on in summer? Bit of an open question.
Yeah, it depends what you're watering as such, but I think the best practice for me personally of pots and things like that, and maybe I don't do what I preach, but If it's going to be a 40-degree day or something the next day, your best bet is in the evening so that it's got all of that cool evening before we're heating up the next day. Pots can tend to heat up that much that you're steaming if they're too wet. So if the plant can live with that stress of the 40-degree day and then once the sun goes down, start watering then. But it all does depend on what, to me, with what you're watering.
I've only been watering my garden at the front before the 35, probably the 40-degree days. And I do the pots the night before now. Yep. Learned that off you. Thank you very much. But the if I can be bothered going out at night and getting up off the couch, then I'll do it at night. Otherwise, it's, you know, early in the morning. But, yeah.
I think it does depend on,
I don't know,
on what you're growing as well. So sometimes there's a bunch of, especially kind of semi-arid and arid native plants that don't like being wet overnight. And you can kind of recharge the soil in the morning and, you know, it gets off the foliage, especially the hairy things. Like, you know, some of the Aeromophilas and that sort of stuff don't love it. So I've had more luck with the dry land things, just doing it in the morning.
And I'm not sure whether Frank's talking about specifically irrigating his olive trees or whether it's a more general question. But, I mean, the other thing to take into account also is that when I was just looking at our local water supply authority, and I don't know what the situation in Melbourne is, but theoretically I shouldn't be using sprinklers during the day because that's not part of our general water restrictions.
Yeah.
And that's just our sort of everyday water restrictions. Mm. So if you're using a sprinkler technically at night, and they recommend that because you lose less through evaporation than running them during the day. How often? I mean, that really is a $64 question or $64 million question. And if we had 2 or 3 hours, we could do the question justice, because it does depend on what you're growing.
And it
does depend on the time of the year, and it does depend on what kind of soil you've got, and it depends on how you're delivering the water, because they all affect the answer. But here's a throwaway. There's a guy I follow on Instagram whose name is Cristobal Elgueta, and Cristobal is a landscape gardener in Santiago in Chile, which has a climate. It's probably drier in the summer than here. I think they are one of those places where it simply doesn't rain for 6 months. And I saw a post of his a couple of years ago where he was pointing to some garden beds and saying the irrigation regime here is that these get 20 litres per square metre every second week. So that's roughly an inch of rain every second week.
Yeah.
So you need to know what your system delivers, how many litres per square metre it's putting out. This is why students hate soil science. It's got numbers in it.
Yeah.
Why can't it all just be pretty? A good soak once every couple of weeks for general garden stuff is probably pretty generous.
Yeah. I think mulch thickness comes into is a variable as well, because we usually say, I remember you used to do this at Cranbourne, is mulch in early spring to capture whatever supposedly came, you know, in winter. I didn't get to mulching the garden at the front until I think it was the start of December, and I mulched it really thick because I couldn't be bothered doing it again in the next 12 months. So I want it to last at least, 2 years. And that front garden has held up. It's a young front garden. Most of the plants there are less than 2 years old, and it has held up so well in this heat. And I swear it's because of the thickness of the mulch, and I've only been watering it before, like, the really, really stinking hot days that we've had so far. So that's...
How do you put the water on?
I don't use sprinklers because I've got...
Is it drippers under the mulch? Or?
No, it's hose coming from the tank.
Okay.
So I just direct it and probably give it a count of, you know, 20.
The water's going past the mulch?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can mulch too thickly as well. And also, especially if you've got sandy soils, mulching... like with overhead irrigation and even water sometimes, you can get sort of this hydrophobic layer where it's not actually, the mulch is soaking it up and you're not really getting anything through the top layer of the soil. So, you know, I love drip for that reason, like in sandy, you know, dry land. I mean, I love my sandy heathland plants and that sort of stuff. So I have a kind of bias, but yeah, if you're going to mulch, especially on sandy soils, you've got to make sure you're trapping that moisture in and not letting it dry out, because as soon as you dry out, you're going to have issues with hydrophobia and that sort of stuff. So
yeah, because I was having a similar conversation with Roger Elliott a little while ago, because a friend in California, I've been helping her with her garden, and it's obviously very dry over there as well. And, you know, we're talking about different strategies, because Roger's been to California a lot and is you know, sort of knows what's going on over there. And he said the same thing is, don't tell them not to mulch too thickly, because any rain that does come possibly won't even reach the soil. Yep. So, I mean, and when I have been watering the garden, I'm like, it's not on the fluffy, misty side of the trigger hose. It's on like the, because I want it to get through the mulch.
The other thing that can happen with mulch, and we ran a year-long trial at the Cranbourne Gardens looking at different mulches, so looking at organic and inorganic, and some of the mulches, like, because we're sand, some of the mulches with the finer stuff was causing issues. Like it almost created like this carpet underlay, for want of a better term, you know, where it was impenetrable. So we found some of the larger kind of hardwood mulches without a lot of that fine stuff. I mean, the trade-off is you're not getting as much like organic material turning over in your soil, like as regularly, but like purely for what you want mulch to do to hold the moisture and that sort of stuff. That was the most effective.
Chunkier.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
What, wasn't a pine bark?
No. I
don't like the pine bark. I'm just
pine bark for me, just because it makes it so acidic, you know. Like
yeah, and there's no organic. Have you ever done studies on like the organic? There's no organic value to pine bark mulches either.
Yeah, and you do get a lot of like we. I'm still saying we about Cranbourne.
You're not part of the team.
I've got to let it go.
Yeah,
I know.
You let it go.
But under the Angophorus, for anyone who knows that garden, when I first got there, you know, 14, 15 years ago, we did the pH, and like we were getting 3.5, 4. Wow. You know, like that's incredibly low.
Wow, cheap.
And you're starting to unlock aluminium and all sorts of stuff at that pH level. There is
a study, and it's a long time ago, like back in the 80s, and I think it's. There's an old journal, and it probably doesn't exist any longer, called the Journal of the Australian Institute of Parks and Recreation. It'll be in libraries. And these guys, and I think they were in Adelaide, did a study looking at the effects of a whole bunch of different kinds of mulch. And I'm sure pine bark must have been in it, and I don't think they found any problem. The one that caused them their big headaches was almond hulls, which made soil extremely alkaline, but... my memory is, other than that, there wasn't anything particularly dramatic. But these sorts of questions, we simply, you know, the work hasn't been done.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
For what it's worth, with a colleague of mine, a guy named Jeff Conlon, who's an irrigation authority, and Jeff's the consultant irrigation designer for the big new project that Russell's part of.
Yeah.
Jeff and I did this piece of work to support a software program, and we had somebody look at water conservation with and without mulch, or water use with and without mulch. And our guess, our estimate from the data we got, was that with mulch over drip, you got about a 20% improvement on water efficiency.
Mm.
So it's not... you know, you're getting double or triple, but 20% is 20%.
Yes.
Yeah.
You
know,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm. All right. We will come back to this water stuff, no doubt, in a moment. We must get to some community announcements. So this is really interesting chat, guys. So thank you. Okay. Some community announcements, everyone. The 2026 Victorian State Dahlia Show is running from the 28th of February to the 1st of March at Mount Waverley. There's growers of dahlias, passionate hobbyists and first-time exhibitors that are coming from all over the state to join the show. Prizes, displays of a huge range of dahlias, and that is on the 28th to the 1st of March at Mount Waverley, and I just haven't got the address there, so I'm going to find that in a second. On the 14th and 15th of March, the Growing Friends at the of the Cranbourne Friends of the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria have their autumn plant sale. This is a very, very popular plant sale. Enthusiasts get there right at the gate opening to get some really, really special Australian plants, which you cannot get easily.
Some of them jump the fence, I think, before they open. Yeah.
Yeah. We would have seen a few.
Good experience with that, haven't we?
Yeah.
It's down the west, be the eastern end of the Botanic Garden, so not up the visitor centre end, but down where the kiosk is. They will have a stock list available 2 weeks before the sale that you can get on their website, which is rbgfriendscranbourne.org. So it's the 14th and 15th of March from 10 till 4 on both days at the Australian Garden in Cranbourne. Now, there's a listener who emailed in a couple of weeks ago about a Eucalyptus cephalocarpa. Russell, I'm looking at you for this. It's popped up in her garden and she's let it do its thing for the last few years to work out what it was. It's maturing and they can't decide if they want to keep it or not because they can get pretty tall.
They can.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the flower smell on the cephalocarpas is amazing.
Like yeah, they're beautiful. Like they smell like honey.
Honey,
yeah. Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
I've walked through, there's a forest of them at Dorset Rec Reserve near where I am, and if you walk past through there in November or something, you just get whacked in the face with this smell. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to keep it. that might not be very good advice. because she says it's close to the house and it's a narrow garden bed, so she doesn't want the shade to outcompete it. Could it be coppiced or could they cut it and let something else grow in the space? What do you reckon, Russ?
I mean, you can, like, they will resprout if you coppice them. They're kind of combination resprouters, so they'll either shoot epicomically, like from the branches, or you can cut them to the ground. I mean, that close to the house, and it sounds like it's probably not quite in the right spot, but because I love all eucalypts equally, it's really hard to say, perhaps that's not the best idea. But they are beautiful trees and they have that like really glaucous new foliage and like really interesting kind of diamond-shaped buds and stuff. They're really cool.
Yeah.
And they're easy to grow as well because they're sandy heathland things. Yeah. So maybe not in that context.
I'm just going to get a couple of photos up for you, Russ. Here we go. It's pretty close to the house. Just go boil the kettle, cuts.
Maybe
listeners.
Yeah, sorry. While we're looking at photos, maybe coppice it to start with, and
see
how she likes it. Then.
No, that's fine. No, that's.
You reckon?
Oh, keep that. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. That's far enough away from the house for sure.
Because they're not the broad. They don't have the broadest canopy of the eucalypts. They're a bit more upright.
Yeah, it depends. Like there can be forms that kind of are a bit spreading, but that looks like it's got a pretty decent kind of central leader, and it's going up. So I would keep that. That's not as close as I thought.
Yeah. He's so stoked.
Yeah.
Now.
Oh man, that's amazing.
You've just saved another eucalypt.
Eucalypt saved. Yeah.
The shoulders just struck with relief.
Oh, so it was stressed. It was awful.
Put his Superman cape back on.
I'm up and about again.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Russell. All right, there's another email come in too from Carl in Croydon. Hi, panel. Not sure if I should let this little spotty, so it's Eucalyptus maniflora maculosa.
Oh, yep, manifera.
Manifera maculosa, the Manny Mac. As its footplate is moving in the wind, it's 3 metres at the moment in Croydon clay. Could I take it down to 2 metres to see if it firms up near winter or just coppice it, which I'd prefer not to?
If the root plate is moving, it's almost certainly got a dud root system.
Yeah.
It's been badly grown, I would think.
Yeah.
And if you want to keep it, coppice it.
If it's only a couple of years old, they grow pretty quick. If you really want that variety, I'd start again and make sure you get a better variety and plant it properly. He sent a couple of videos, but I didn't see
them. It's only a baby tree, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because if you coppice it, it's not going to be the tree. It's going to be, you know, a large shrub.
But my,
so yeah. It's going to, the habit is going to change.
My best advice would be that sometimes a tree like that will grow a new root system over the top of the undoubtedly sort of pot-bound roots it's got. But the only way you know that is by continuing to check its stability.
Mm.
So,
you know. I think the issue with bad root systems on big trees is you're always a bit worried. Yeah. You're better off at that height getting a new tree that's been well-grown.
Yeah.
Like, and also, you know, if you're thinking about chopping them and all of that sort of stuff, like you get, and unless you're an arborist, like you start to play around with the structure of the tree, and if they get bigger and you want to bring it down, then you've got to manage all the epicormics, which, you know, is a whole other issue. So my advice would just be get a decent tree.
I would start again because it's a younger tree.
Yep.
They're an easy plant to get hold to source.
Yeah, there's heaps of them.
Like go up to Karanga and have a look at the row of plants that they will have in stock of the little spotties.
Yep.
And
do a bit of
wiggle test.
Yeah.
Wiggle test, yes.
Look, wiggle test, even, you know, put your hand
Sorry,
over.
Sorry.
Do the wiggle.
It's a core horticultural thing.
Yeah. It's a real technical conversation we're having right now.
Put your hand over the pot and flip it upside down and have a look at the root system. A little bit of potting mix will fall out, but, you know, and make sure that there's no roots that are starting to circle around that black pot. I mean, that's the downside to those solid black pots for trees, particularly eucalypts, is that, you know, root binding can start quite young. Can you, and have you root pruned a eucalypt before if it's looked like that? With some other trees you can.
Oh, I mean, you can root prune anything within reason.
So you could essentially just root prune it.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah.
And also you can buy those little spotties in, you know, 45-litre, 100-litre, you know, from bigger tree growers. It'll cost you, you know, a couple of $100, but you basically get a similar size
if not bigger.
To the tree in the photo.
And you've got, going back to the wiggle test, with a big tree like that, you've got a much better chance of picking up a faulty root system.
Yeah.
Hopefully they've already done it as part of their quality control.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Hopefully that is helpful, Carl. Just jumping back to the Victorian State Dahlia Show, so the 28th of Feb to the 1st of March, the address for that is the Mount Waverley Community Centre on 47 Miller Crescent, Mount Waverley. $5 for adults, $2 for concession, and kids are free. Garden clubs, photographers, plant lovers, everyone is encouraged to come and see some beautiful flowers. Russell, you had a little community announcement.
I do. This is a shameless plug from MAPCO.
Loves it.
But we have been working with the City of Melbourne and the Melbourne Pollinator Corridor group, so Emma Cutting, for those who know about this. And we are launching an insect guide.
Yay.
Which is really cool. So I'm super excited about this. I'm becoming more obsessed with insects the older I get. I don't know why, but perhaps it's because I've got no friends anymore.
Lucky you're married, because you get no one now.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah. I mean, yeah, my family are Jew, is it? But yeah. I don't think they're loving it, to be fair. but that is, the launch is at 10 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of Feb, in Fed Square. So it's going to be held in the Edge. And we have a couple of cool speakers. So we've got Kylie Soans, who's an urban ecologist, Kate Pierce, who is at Zoos Victoria Invertebrates Nut.
She's one of my favourite people. I love her.
Great speaker too.
Yeah.
Like, really
Kate's
great.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Biggest bug person going around.
Loves it.
Yeah.
Absolutely loves
so
it.
So passionate. So excitable.
That's pretty exciting.
Yay.
Emma Cutting from Heartscapes. Amazing garden tour. That'll be me. and facilitated by Dr. Freya Thomas, who works for the City of Melbourne. So you turn up, you get refreshments, there's a whole bunch of stalls, you get a free insect guide.
Oh, what
and,
a day.
Like, it'll be a really fun day.
Yeah,
so awesome. So come down. You can look at it on the website, like it's a Eventbrite or Humanitix or something like that. So registering is important, but it's all free.
Yeah.
Yep.
Can you give the date again?
28th of Feb.
Time?
At 10 o'clock.
Toss up between dahlias.
I know.
And
yeah.
Dahlias.
Well, you can, yeah. Bugs. You can do both.
So, you do both. The dahlia thing goes all weekend.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So come down here Saturday morning and then off to the dahlia. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
What a lovely day. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see a few of you there.
Cool. Thank you. Jane, what did you have?
I want to talk about the Fenny Creek Horticultural Society Collectors Expo.
Please.
Now, in the past, it's been held on the long weekend in March, so usually around 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, whichever that sort of falls in March. However, this year, they're doing something a little bit exciting and new, so they're combining that with their fabulous autumn show. So if anyone's been to the autumn show, the entire hall is filled with, like, sort of nearly 3,000 entries of autumn flowering things and autumn foliage and other potted plants and stuff, and it all gets judged and awards given and things. That's fabulous in its own, but if anyone's also been to the Plant Collectors Expo, that in itself is one of the most amazing plant events in Victoria that you can go to.
Yeah.
And at this stage, it's kind of one of the only ones that are happening this year. So they're combining the two. So it's going to be on the 18th and 19th of April, still from 10 till 4, both the Saturday and Sunday. But the good thing is that you can get the benefit of both the shows.
It's going to be a whopper of a show.
Oh yeah. So maybe get there early for parking. I mean, there is heaps of parking on the oval next door, but I think that might get a bit chock-a-block too.
Yeah.
But so all the usual vendors and things that you see, so the Ben and Kerry Treasure Perennials and us and
Meryl Johnson.
Hopefully Meryl will be there with her seed and stuff too. But heaps of other little backyarder type of growers as well, that you can find something really, really rare or something you've been looking for years and things. It's a great opportunity to meet people. There's a speaker's tent as well. And all the talks are free, so you can just come and go and sit and have a relax and listen. Food. The CFA does all the parking and stuff, so let's, you know, support our local CFAs that are under the pump at the moment. And the big thing is it's a $9 entry. Like, under 18s for free. It's $9.
A man.
It is the cheapest plant show in the country. Like, unbelievable. So, yeah, just mark your diaries for the 18th and 19th of April rather than that long weekend. And that way it prevents us having to sort of reschedule and cancel due to Mother Nature telling us she's a bit PO'd with us.
Did that happen last year or
the year before? The year before, yeah.
But for a couple of years now it's been a little bit touch and go of whether the March show was going to go ahead.
And planning these things is
my
hat goes off to Emma Moisey, who is generally in charge of running this. And if you're still sleeping in, hey, Pete, go make her a cup of tea.
Yeah.
she does a fabulous job. And the stress of having to cancel that one a couple of years ago because of the weather conditions and stuff, like, terrible. Like, so I think this is a brave move, but it's also combining, so it's not postponing or any of that sort of stuff. It's making this bigger and better, so why not?
I think it's a great idea putting it all together.
So
it's
come and
make
say hello.
A massive show.
Yeah.
Get Jane's autograph for anyone that goes up there.
Yeah.
Might be worth something one day.
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah.
It could be worth something now. Away. I didn't mean it like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's out there. Yeah. How about you bite your tongue? Yeah, cheeky, I tell you. Yeah.
Thanks, Jane and Russ, for those little announcements. Lots of fun things going on. A listener email that came in early in January, so I hope you might catch up on the podcast. I don't know. They're after a particular plant. The common name is the devil's hand tree, and it has a wicked scientific name. Mm-hmm. Do you know it, Russ?
No.
I'm going to say it because it's going to be fun. Chiranthodendron.
Yes.
Pentadactylon.
Mm-hmm.
Such a great name. If you've got your phone next to you at the moment, listeners, Google the devil's hand tree. It's a wicked, wicked plant from South America, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, isn't it?
Yeah. Matt was trying to source the plant and he hasn't been able to get it from a couple of places. Virginia's done a little bit of a ring around in the last couple of days, and Yamina Rare Plants up in Monbulk do have some in stock. So get in contact with those. So Yamina is Y-A-M-I-N-A. to get hold of that. I think they do post plants too, Matt, if you're a little bit further out from Melbourne. So, all right, we've got quite a few text messages to get through, They've all come in. If anyone wants to give us a call and join the chat or ask a question, the number is 94190155. The text line, which you guys seem to have saved in your phones, is 0488 809 855. And if you do have some images to send us, 3cr.gardening@gmail.com is the email address to send it to. Carl from Croydon says, thanks, everyone. So that's good. We obviously gave him some helpful information. Listener Kim is looking forward to the Fernie Creek show. Glad it's later and combined. That's some good feedback. And they got some great plants last time they went. Which means she can go to the Ballarat Begonia Festival on the March long weekend now, instead of having to pick between Fernie Creek and Ballarat. So what a win.
Yep. So there you go. There's a Begonia Festival on that long weekend in March. We'll get some details on maybe next week.
Yep.
Plug that too.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, we'll definitely be talking about the show leading up to April. Yep. A listener has messaged in, and I was going to mention this as well. There's a local nursery on Colchester Road in Kilsyth that has been there for a very long time. It is my local nursery. I love going up there and getting my mulch from there particularly. The whole nursery didn't, but the building and shed caught fire and burnt down during the week, this week.
Mm.
If anyone is in that area of the eastern suburbs, they are open. They're taking cash only at the moment, I've been told. The main thing that burnt down was the building. So there's still heaps of plants there, and their garden supplies is still there as well. So, yeah, Colchester Nursery, it's on Colchester Road in Kilsyth, in between Canterbury Road and Mountain Highway. Get out there and
throw some support
them. Yeah, yep. Support them if you can, and go to the ATM beforehand. Another question from Rosie from Mount Eliza. Enjoying the show, but could you repeat the names occasionally of the plants you are discussing? We will try very hard to do that, Rosie. The last plant I mentioned was the Devil's Hand tree. I'm not going to say that botanical name again because it won't help you.
I didn't know it, and I just looked it up. It's outrageous.
Isn't it?
It's very cool.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a City of Melbourne trial tree planting in Jolimont.
Okay.
There's a little grassy park that runs parallel to the railway line on the MCG side of the railway line.
Right.
And they put about 20 things that they were evaluating for possible climate change response.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And there's a few of those.
Yeah, right. How are they going?
Good.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't seen it for a few years.
But yeah, cool. Yeah.
All right. Couple more text messages to get through. Hi, team. Regarding mulch, how thick is thick in millimetres? This listener is in Eltham, and they've tested the test garden depth is about 10 times deeper than my soil. They live on a hillside. Yes, it would be. So mulch thickness. What I would have mulched was probably in the realm of 150 to 200 mil before Christmas.
Wow.
That's very deep.
It's a lot, yes.
No, let's go 100, max 150.
Yes.
200 bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very deep.
The standard advice is 75 millimetres.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want a sort of a number, that's the one that most of the authorities say is what you want. But if it's very fine material, that's probably too much. But I think
we've
probably all agreed that very fine materials aren't great mulches.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
The thick one, ones are definitely, or chunkier ones are definitely better.
So 75 to 100.
75, yeah. Look, Eltham soils are challenging. They're very hard and they're very compacted. And if you're on a hillside as well, I wouldn't be mulching that thick because any rain would potentially just wash it away. So I'd probably be looking at applying, 50 to 75 mil of mulch, and you might just have to do that annually.
And you're probably better off getting it, because you can get standard mulches, so you can get 20 mil hardwood or whatever. Yeah. But if you can get a combination of, you know, 10 mil and 20 mil so it binds together on a slope, they actually go a bit better than just a single size. They just seem to migrate down the slope a bit differently. Yeah. I'm so stingy with my mulch. Like
I'm one of the few things I'm generous with.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And I guess it's like, you know, because I'll only mulch to 50.
Yeah.
You know? But probably depends on the context.
That's interesting that too, sort of because stuff. You have sandy soil and I have clay loam soil, which holds more water.
Yeah.
I probably don't need to mulch as thickly as I do.
Yeah.
You were just trying to make it last 2 years.
Exactly. So it's a convenience.
It's definitely a consideration, like especially in big public landscapes. Like you would never mulch at 50 because you'd have to do it again and again and again. I think in my garden I can just, you know, grab a bag and I'm fine.
Yeah. I'm thinking with this thick mulch I've done, I'll probably just like patch mulch.
Yeah.
Like this stuff's going to last for ages that I put on.
Yeah.
And there's some plants that, you know, Micromyrtus ciliata, which grows around little desert through the Grampians.
Yeah.
That's very dry tolerant. It's not thick around that plant. So there were some plants that didn't get the level of thickness that some other ones got, because I've got a couple of other plants. So Cutia viburnia that grows up in the Dandenongs that's going to need a lot more protection and consistent, you know, moisture. So that it got pretty thick around there.
And again, it's about what you're growing. Like, you know, if you're growing rainforest species that have adventitious roots and that sort of stuff, they're fine. Like, you can absolutely bury them. But if you're, you know, we're talking about Eremophilas and that sort of stuff before, if you bury them, like, they get collar rot and all of that sort of stuff. So,
A Corias as well can get collar rot if the mulch is too heavily up to them.
A lot of the Rutaceae stuff.
Yeah.
Croias, Baronias, all of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Micromyrtus too, by the way. What a plant. Oh. I went past an old unit that I used to live in and it buds up for months and then flowers. You get so much value out of them. And they actually, like if you go to places like the Grampians, they'll be in those kind of seasonal wet spots. So they can actually deal with moisture more than people think. But, you know, I had this thing in Grace Anne's and after establishment never watered it.
Yeah.
And it's... Like, I love them. They're so pretty. Just full of flower.
I've got three different varieties that I bought, and I think I bought the three of them in last year into the studio when I bought them before I planted them, because I wanted to see what the three different varieties, how they'd go in a similar spot. And two of them are definitely way better than the other one.
Yeah.
And the other one, the one that's not looking so good, is the one that had the prettiest label on it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, so, they needed it.
Yeah.
Like, this is beautiful, I promise.
Yeah, it was all dolled up. It's had its face on. And it looks like rubbish. It doesn't like my soil. It dropped it went yellow and dropped its older leaves at the bottom of the plant, which is usually a sign that it's a bit too much moisture.
Yeah.
And the other ones have just been happily doing their thing. They kept flowering for ages.
Mm.
So the one that I'll bring them in again. I'll keep talking about them. The one that isn't doing so great is called Wartook Wonder.
Yeah. Okay.
For anyone, and the one that's looking the best had an average plant label on it.
Yeah.
And it's a corangiform called Hollow Mountain Pink Buds.
Right.
So. It's from Hollow Mountain in the Grampians, and it's the pink-butted form.
There you go.
And it's just got that little sticker on the on a standard plain old label.
And there's quite a few different forms. There's some more upright ones and then those really low kind of branching.
Mate, when I was at Little Desert last year with Graeme and Marie Goods, we went
you
past
You keep rubbing
this,
that
like,
in. I was supposed to be going around. Yeah.
The FOMO. We went through, obviously, it's just sand dunes through Little Desert, and there was this big patch of, like, beautiful bright white sand, and there were these – it looked like – a broomstick. Mm. They were round, about 20 centimetres in diameter, and just vertical of this form of Micromyrtus ciliata.
Yeah.
Like you could rip it out the ground, shove a broomstick on it, and like fly away.
That from it. From a distance, they look like mini corries, mini pine trees or something. They're like, it's such a conical habit, those ones.
It's such a cool plant.
Yeah.
They're such a cool plant. Have you got any of those in your garden, Peter?
No, I don't. No?
Might want to think about it.
I don't have a lot of native plants.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of local native grass. But most of the garden is exotic.
Yep, the photos that I have seen of yours are some, you know, beautiful a lot of perennials, like herbaceous perennials?
Yeah, the stuff that's got some capacity to deal with dry late summers, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of a mix of, you know, I'm a post-Adolfian. I like, you know, my gardening sort of inspiration. If I could do it, I'd love to have a Pete Adolf garden, but mm-hmm. you can't do that in Australia.
Yeah.
So I started out with that in mind, and it's become more woody with time because they're the plants that work in this kind of in this kind of environment. So now it's a mix of perennials and woody stuff.
Yeah, okay.
And inevitably, I will have to start including more local native stuff in it. I just haven't worked out what they are and how I'm going to use them yet, what they can do. So it's a learning thing.
Oh yeah, and it's constantly changing as well. Yeah.
And I don't want to claim that I'm an expert on this. I would describe myself as a well-informed backyard gardener.
You're probably a little bit better informed than most people.
Geez, we're struggling then.
Yeah,
aren't we?
I know. Yeah. Well,
you've got a pretty impressive resume, Peter.
But I'm not a gardener, not a professional gardener in that sense. So,
Yeah. It's interesting. I was just going to say the, you know, the co-designers of Luck Bund Up and the Test Garden, James Sitchmoyne, Nigel Dunnett, you know, that naturalistic planting style. It'd be really interesting to see how that translates to the Southern Hemisphere. You know, we don't have, a Pete Adolf garden in the middle of winter. Like, you've got all the dead seed heads and, you know, it's under snowpack and that sort of stuff. And we don't have that. And part of that is understanding how to manage these naturalistic landscapes through growing seasons, because it is growing season in the middle of winter. It's mild, you know, and whether some of those selections can hold up to the, you know, the extreme kind of heat and that sort of stuff. So
absolutely. James, I had the privilege of working with James for 10 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of the way I've come to think about landscape comes from stuff that I've absorbed from him.
Yeah.
And he was working in Melbourne for long enough to know what the conditions are like. And it will be interesting to see how that comes out. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And
those combinations, we were talking about this yesterday at the Open Day, because you've got such a diversity of species and we're trialling things that haven't worked, haven't been grown together, you kind of have to set these thresholds around, like, aesthetics, what you need the garden to look like in a public landscape, but also the amount of resources. Like, you stress to kind of slow these plants down so you're not constantly pruning or weeding and that sort of stuff. And, it will all be about, you know, that changes depending on how much irrigation you're putting on or how much food you're giving them or, you know, different species combinations. So it's about that kind of Venn diagram and looking at the overlap of where do most of these species survive. And there's going to be some casualties, but there's going to be things that surprise you as well. Some plants can be really, really plastic. In the test garden, we've got a couple of different Phlomis, like Phlomis sahiana, like a little carpet Phlomis that's really struggled and hates the winter wet.
Yes.
But Phlomis lanata, you know, from similar areas, is thriving, you know. So it'll just be about recording that and making those decisions as we go. But it's really fun, you know, to see all these combinations kind of working or not together. Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see, the test garden. I mean, it's every season you go to, it's different. There's different plants
different
coming
mood.
Up. And
It's
very moody. It's a very moody
it's
garden.
So moody. Yeah. It matches me, actually. Yeah. It's like pretty.
Well, we weren't going to say it.
Thought I'd get in first. I knew it was coming.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that on structure planting is that if you're concerned about water stress and water use, and we have to be.
Yep.
A lot of the vegetation that you would use to respond to a low water use landscape, they don't like shallow soil.
Correct.
You know, then it's not their thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the plants that do are things like sedums that grow on the tops of rock walls.
The rocks. Mm. Yep. Yep.
But a lot of that Mediterranean sort of sub-shrubby herbaceous crossover things, you know, they need deep soils to...
Yeah. We were having this chat as well, and I think I mentioned it last time, but you think of, you know, I'm still learning about a lot of these exotic perennials, but if you think about things like Tylotus or Eryngium in the Western Plains, like they have huge taproots.
Yes.
So you're taking away, like, the advantage in a soil that's only, you know, 200 or 150.
Yes.
They don't have the ability to set a taproot like that. So their persistence in the landscape, you almost use them as annuals. Well, you in that environment.
Yeah.
So it changes how you're using them in horticulture. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
I mean, have you ever dug up Gowra?
No.
They've got roots like this.
Really? Yeah, there you go.
You've got this little delicate thing on top.
Yeah.
And underground, it's this monster.
Yeah.
It's and that's where it gets its resilience.
Yeah, from, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there's things, I went to Portugal last year, just rubbing in another holiday.
Oh, but, nice. Is it paying you well? Is that co place?
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. It's been great. but the Crithmum on the beach, I chased one of those roots. They're like 2.5 metres down.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's unbelievable, you know, and they can't do that in the test garden.
No.
They're still going pretty well in the test garden, but if you're talking about water conservation, like, you're taking away that adaptation that can, like, provide
It means judging the irrigation is going to be a very, very skilled operation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right, guys, we have a phone call to get to, and I will say thank you, Margot. Hello there. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, that's fine.
It's Margot McDonald. Hello.
Hello there, team. Doing a great job. I'm just pruning an apple tree with a new technique that I learned from the 3CR Garden Program by Craig Castry to reduce the growth on an apple tree. And it's a simple thing. I'm so impressed. It's just by pruning not below a node, but above a node, well above. So you've got all these little stubs left above where the new growth will come out. So it reduces the vigour of the new growth, I believe. But anyway, I'm having fun doing that. But my real question is about soil. I've got native bed, and we're on old gold mining country, hard yellow clay. And for years, I've had a few Banksias in for what would be 12 years, never flowered, and I have rung up about it before, and it's still a mystery. But the other day I did soil test, and it's really high in alkalinity. So I was just wondering if Peter could remind us all and give me some solutions. I mean, I sort of basically know it, but if he's got any other ideas and how to remediate the soil on a big scale, to fix the alkalinity. And I think that's what's wrong with the Banksias.
See, this is where you and I, Margot... Hello, Margot, how are you?
Hello there, Peter.
This is where you and I might diverge on this question.
Okay.
See, my response to this sort of situation is that the cheapest and most effective solution to a large-scale problem with soil alkalinity is you change your plants.
Aha.
You don't.
Fair enough.
So if you've got a plant that's not performing, get rid of it and get something that does, because there actually isn't a way of, I think, easily resolving an alkaline soil problem on a large scale. The classical response, you look it up, and the answer is you apply sulphur.
Yeah.
Elemental sulphur.
Yep.
How much you apply depends on soil texture and what your pH is.
Yep.
And if you're going to do that, then you need to get your soil tested rather than using a home kit.
Yep.
In my experience, home soil pH soil testing kits are really bad at being accurate in... sorry, it's put very poorly put. They're not accurate in alkaline soils. They tend to go just, it's pH 11.
Well, that's certainly what I did.
And in reality, it may not be anywhere near that.
Okay.
There's something
but
about...
Well, all the Banksias were very yellow, and I have, you know, over the years applied, you know, various iron sort of deficiency things and...
Yeah, it's...
Compost and...
If you're going to try changing the soil, sulphur is the recommendation.
way to go.
Yeah, but realistically, look for banksias that don't mind alkaline soils. There's got to be some because there'll be alkaline soils in Western Australia that grow on. And,
yeah.
And Banksia marginata, I'm sure, would work.
Yeah.
And
ornata. Well, that's what they are.
You know, there's a few
things.
They
are marginatas.
Yeah, they're marginata.
Gosh.
Yeah.
There's a few through, you know, it's pretty alkaline out through the northwest, the old inland sea, those mallee regions. So, you know, Banksia ornata. So, Integrafolia does okay in high pH, but there's.
Might not tolerate our frosts. Margot's up where I am and it's very cold.
Yeah, true. No, they don't like frost at all.
Ornata is a possibility, though.
Yeah. And there's a couple of little ones like Petilaris and, you know, some of those ground-hugging ones.
But that don't mind. Yeah, look, my go-to recommendation for soil problems of any sort is that if you've got an intractable soil problem, then plants are the cheapest solution.
Mm.
Finding the plants that tolerate.
Peonies, Margot. Peonies.
Well, there you go.
bit exposed, I think.
Get frost, they love it.
Yeah, and it's under old, you know, really old 100-year-old gum trees, so it's difficult. All the West Indies and Corias are doing really well, but it's just these Banksias, which I love. And we've got Banksias in other areas, and the black cockatoos have just stripped them. They love them. Mm. They come every year and have a feast. So if they do grow here, climate-wise, but not in that particular area.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much. So I will have a good think about it.
But look up sulphur treatments as a possibility. Yeah.
I shall. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Margot. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Any final comments on alkalinity before we move on to some text messages, guys?
I think depending on what you're growing, like organic matter is your friend as well. So, if you're adding compost and all of that sort of stuff, like you can start to bring pH down or up. It does depend on what you're growing. But, yeah, I think it's much, much easier to bring it up with lime than bring it down with sulfates and stuff.
Absolutely.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, let's get to some text messages because quite a few have rolled in. David from Upway says, good morning, everyone. He got a box of goodies from Jane last week, which he's very excited about. But he asks about what are the best conditions for growing jujubes in? Does anyone know?
Hot, I would think.
Yeah, they're usually grown up in around Mildura
in
the Riverina.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know specifically. It would be like a well-drained soil,
but if
hot spot in the garden.
Yeah, full sun or as sunny as you can get.
Yep.
And people could grow avocado in Melbourne. So, but I would think you would need as sunny and bright and hot a spot as you can find. The tree probably grows all right, whether you ripen the fruit.
Yeah, well that's the thing. So David's in Upway, which might be, I don't know how it would go in winter, getting through winter up there.
Might be a bit cold.
Yeah.
Damn. Louis Glavinsky's book on fruit growing.
Yes.
If you haven't got a copy of it, borrow it from the library.
Yeah.
Almost certainly Louis will have talked about jujubes. Yeah.
That book is called The Complete Guide to Fruit Growing in Australia, but he's a Melbourne-based writer, so it's going to be some really pertinent information in there. Yeah, that's a
good. And thank you, David, for ordering yet again, and your support is amazing. He orders every catalogue, so thank you.
Beautiful.
I think it was David.
P.S. catalogue's out at the moment, www.tonkinsbulbs.com.au.
Yes. We haven't got to that yet. Jeez, we need to stop talking and just get moving. I think it was David last week that reminded everyone that I've been on 3CR for 10 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Now. I know. I'm putting him from a long service leave. okay, let's get to some text messages. One listener has messaged in saying they got a devil's hand tree from Don and Peter Tease at Yamina Plants. Theirs is about 6 metres high after being planted 10 years ago. And they've seen several planted along the railway near Jolimont too. And there's four in Melbourne Botanic Gardens, so thank you. Peter and Vicky from Notting Hill said, thanks to Jane for your talk on Friday at the Waverley Garden Club. Good on you, Janie.
Jane's obviously worded a couple of people up to text in and have a chat about how well you're doing out there.
Well, it was fun. Waverley Garden Club is huge. There was like 120 people there, which is a bit daunting when you know. And Pete and Vicky were sitting in front row, ready to heckle and stuff. So
legends.
Good morning.
To be fair, I have heard you talk, and you're very good.
Yeah, she's.
Yeah.
I was expecting something else to come out of your mouth.
That was a backhand comment. Though.
Yeah.
Tone was horrible.
I've heard you talk. You're good, but
No but this time. Yeah.
All right, community announcement from a listener. It is Craig Castry here. He's please let listeners know that they can join us at the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard for the Fruit Tree Festival on Sunday, the 1st of March. It's the festival and they're grafting all day as well. So it's from 10 till 3. Entry is free, so you can come along and see how grafting is done. You can source a range of rare and heritage scion and grafted trees, and there's a whole heap of other, there's some workshops and lots of learning and a big community day happening then. So Sunday the 1st of March at the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard, which is within the Werribee Mansion precinct. Their website is werribeeparkheritageorchard.org.au. And I'm just going to ask the girls to scroll to the top. Thank you. Oh, they're coming in hot and fast. listener from Ringwood East, they have a very healthy persimmon tree which used to crop heavily. For the past few years, though, it has had very few fruit despite having lots of flower. Plenty of bees visit the flowers, but most of the fruit drops off at the immature stage. Oh, this is Anne in Ringwood East. Is there any suggestions for the persimmon tree? I'm going to throw in an anecdote since I'm getting dead air.
Yeah.
We had a persimmon tree at Fairfield campus and I didn't know it was a persimmon tree. I've walked past this tree a million times and I've never noticed any fruit, and you can't not notice persimmon fruit on a tree. One of our classes manured it and mulched it in probably towards the end of winter last year, and it flowered and has fruited for the first time. I've never seen it.
I was going to suggest that if it's been good and it's stopped being good, then one of the things you'd want to check would be water stress.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Given our dry winters and springs, that maybe the tree has been stressed in that critical fruit set time.
Yep.
And
so might need a bit of extra water through those, when it starts, maybe when just leading up to flowering and during
I would think at flowering and for the month after,
and then possibly when the fruit is developing too.
Yeah, once you've got the fruit on, then you need to keep some level of water availability to let the fruit size up.
Yeah.
But if the tree gets stressed at fruit set and in that early fruit growth period, then I think you do get fruit drop.
Yeah.
But also the fruit will be then set to be small because you don't get enough cell division to allow a large fruit to develop.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a persimmon tree at home which gets lots of little tiny persimmons because I'm miserly with water.
We've established that. Yeah.
But not anywhere enough.
I'm going to come up and counsel your plants, I think, just to see how they're going.
Oh, there's another holiday for it.
It's a work trip. Barley kind of.
And look, it might need a bit of a feed as well. Possibly, if it's dropping fruit, so that there could be a bit of water stress, but it may not have enough nutrition because there's a lot of energy that plants have to create to put into, fruit and flower production, particularly in our food plants too. So some either organic fertilizer pellets and or manure, and that might set you up for the next season.
And a good solid drink.
Yeah, and a really good drink, yep. Okay, Priscilla from Pakenham has asked, she bought a salvia in tube stock, but she has compacted soil. Should she plant it straight into the ground or put it into a bigger pot first?
I wouldn't be planting it in the middle of summer in compacted ground.
Yep.
I think the biggest issue is why is your soil compacted, and what can you do to decompact it? A lot of salvias do good drainage and that sort of stuff. So I assume, like a bit of, depending on what's going on, a bit of gypsum and organic matter to kind of break up that profile and get it, you know, less compacted. What I'm loving about this, and maybe because it's because you're here, Peter, but like soil is everything when it comes to gardens.
I know.
Like you really, like 90% of your problems come from either planting things in soils that they don't like or having issues like compaction and that sort of stuff.
And alkalinity.
So, yeah, exactly. But I don't have a crack at your soil before you plant it, and definitely not at this time of year.
Look, yeah. If
so in the interim, put it in a bigger pot.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let it do some growing.
Yeah.
And then I'd reckon, I'm with Russell, I mean, I think it sounds like it's going to need some organic matter. So something like, you know, let's put numbers on it. You'd want, I don't know, 25 to 30 to 40 millimetres of compost spread over an area of two or three times the size of the pot, dug into the top 150.
Yeah.
Just loosely broken up, plant into that, should be fine.
Mm.
Yeah. And, yeah, if you put it, and it doesn't need to be put up into a really big pot, just a 14-centimetre, 6-inch pot that we probably all have millions of them lying around, and then, you know, you can plant it. Salvias will still be actively growing right now, so it should fill that 6-inch pot pretty quickly.
Sure, yeah.
And then, yeah, plant it, you know, in mid to late autumn.
Yeah.
And probably won't have to do too much to it until next summer when it needs a prune.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. All right. A message from listener John, they have a small inner north backyard with most plants of varying types collected over 20 or so years. They're in pots from 8-inch to 20-inch sizes. For various reasons, they need to reluctantly and drastically reduce the number of pots and would appreciate our suggestions on passing them on to plant lovers or elsewhere rather than putting them in the green bin. We're not on social media. What suggestions do we have?
Garden clubs. If there's a local garden club.
Yeah.
I find garden clubs are like people share stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mavis brings in a twig of this and cutting of that for somebody else, and it's the way you can make friends, but you can also share stuff so that it's not going to waste. Like if you've got ample, even fruit and veggies, if you're growing your own, you take them down to the local garden club. That would be my suggestion straight up.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially if they're wanting to give them away rather than selling them.
And inner north, I'd be going, Preston Garden Club is one of the bigger garden clubs, and they're just a bunch of legends.
Yep. And
so
maybe
they've got a website, if you want to get onto them.
And give them a call. They might even come around. Someone from a club might come around and give them some advice or something, because it sounds like it's a bit of a task for them too.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And this is not, and my response, this isn't meant to be facetious, but why not do it like your old fridge? Put a couple of them out in the nature strip with a sign that says
free
to good home.
Yep.
Mm.
Don't put them all out at once.
Mm.
But
because
if somebody walks past and says, well, that's nice, I'd love that, it's gone to a good home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
People love free plants as well. There's something about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Drives people crazy.
Might also find one of the charity shops. I know there's a couple up in the Dandenongs that actually have a sort of little nursery alongside the clothing part of. So there might be a charity shop that may also come and pick up things as well.
Probably also depends how rare these things are. Like if you've got something really, really rare, like you can speak to botanic gardens and that sort of stuff, you know, because like garden clubs are friends of the gardens, potentially going to grow that, and they might cultivate in the gardens, and probably depends what it is.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a bit of a collection there, so
hopefully
that's been helpful, John. I think we're up to date with text messages for now. We're still here for another 15 or so minutes. This is the 3CR Gardening Show. I'm Chloe Foster. In the studio with me today is Jane Tonkin, Russell Lark and Peter May. There's been a strong water theme chatting about this morning, and soils and challenges with soils as well. But let's jump on to a couple of plants we haven't got to yet that you guys have brought in. We're going to go with Russell first.
Okay. I was looking at Jane's. I'm like, what is that thing?
It's possibly so scary looking device.
Yeah.
It's right in my face at the moment too.
Well, I'm sorry. Okay.
We should take a photo of this. I'm feeling a little underwhelming with my selection, but anyway. Yeah. So I have got a couple of gardenias, and these are my favourite gardenias. So most people will probably know, especially if you're Victorian, yellow-flowered, you know, gardenia ovata or varia or heteraceae. They're generally the ones in cultivation. But I've got gardenia macmillanii, which is an endemic Victorian species. It's actually pink, and it can go a deep purple as well. And what I love about this plant, so it's only found like along the Macalester River. I did a bit of collecting in a last life, and also the Upper Snowy, and they're always on rocky slopes, and they're always in rain shadows, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So they actually look quite lush. So it's called the pinnate gardenia. So it's got a divided leaf, and it's got these really cool tooth margins. But they are pretty solid in the garden, so they'll kind of gently sucker through your garden. They look lush, but you can grow them in a dry garden. They can tolerate like full sun, but they're also pretty good in part shade and even deep shade sometimes. They won't flower as much in the deep shade, but they smell magical. They are unbelievable during the day. Jane and I were talking about this. Like, how do we describe this? I think it's like perfumey, fruity, or something. I don't know.
And there's this kind of baby powder smell to it.
Yeah,
in a good way.
A really good way.
It reminds me of
not the nappy, right?
It reminds me of Californian salvias.
Yes,
that really sort of pungent, dusty.
Yeah. That's a good call, actually.
Lovely on a hot day.
Yeah.
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 Like, smells almost a petrol note in it. It's not a bad thing, you know.
So during, you know, the hot weather, this flowers until, you know, late summer, but it can you get spot flowers all year, which is pretty cool. And one thing that's been really interesting in my garden, the blue banded bees were only going for the salvias, and I only planted this since last summer. And they will not go near the salvias now. They love this thing.
Yeah.
It's a great plant. Mm. It's threatened in Victoria as well, which is kind of cool. And it's nice to see that.
So where can people find to
get it from?
So you'd probably be able to pick it up from specialist native nurseries. Karanga and those guys. Possibly the Friends of Cranny.
I reckon Cran and Friends probably do grow it.
Yeah.
Can you spell it out for people?
Yes.
F-R. Gardenia macmillanii. So do you want me to spell that?
Yeah.
No, wanted so that we've, because we're supposed to repeat.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, true. The pinnate gardenia. Look that up. And, yeah, it's a fantastic plant. It's really cool.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah,
easy to propagate too from
like Peter, this suckers. Might be a candidate for your garden.
Well, I was thinking that very much, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Winner.
So why isn't it in the trade? But I could ask that question over and over.
Yeah.
And over.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
And this is a bugbear of mine. There are so many. At Cranbourne, I was working on the Raising Rarity program. There are so many plants that aren't in cultivation that should be, like Australian natives. Anyway. There's a lot of people that do good work, but there's a little bit of a hole in the industry, I think, since, you know, some of the original gangsters like, you know, Gwen and Roger Elliott and, Bill Molyneux and
Neil Marriott
and all of those guys. You know, there's definitely a niche there to get out and grow some of these things and make them available.
Yeah, for sure. We'll get a photo up onto the socials for that. I think people will love it. All right, moving on to the plant that is in my face at the moment, Jane, that you brought in. That's fine.
Is it offensive to you?
Well, it's not a native, so.
Oh, listen to this. All right, I'm going home. Seriously, I've had enough. Well, do you know what? Sometimes we need to branch out in life.
It's native somewhere.
Yes.
Yes. It's native to the foothills of the Himalaya through into China.
Oh, that is exotic.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've offended it.
I know.
Okay, the poor thing.
It's withering right now in front of me.
What I have in the studio for, you know, because we forget that it's not a visual thing, is an Aracema. So Aracemas are a member of the aroid family. So there's a lot of people out there that have a aroid fascination. Thank you very much, Chloe, including me. And yes, they are a bit exotic. So nice afternoon, shady spot, well drained. So if anyone knows of arums, you get the spadix in the middle, and generally there's this spathe behind. But aracemas tend to have a little hood that comes up over the top. And at the end of that spathe is that long tendril that you might be able to see in the studio.
Mm.
And the idea of that is to encourage pollination. All aracemas, well, 99% of them are pollinated by fungus gnats.
Really?
So that is an attractive thing to the fungus gnats. And the coolest thing about them is that most of them, it is that they start off as a boy. So the fungus gnat can get in,
yeah.
And then he can get out at the bottom. Once the aracema is to a mature stage, or when the weather conditions are right, that tuber changes to a girl.
Whoa.
Yes, I said mature and then changes to a girl.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is one of the only things in the world, this genus, that can change its sex.
Wow.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
It's like a Nemo flower.
Yeah.
Mm.
So if anyone wants to, you know, look up aracema, A-R-I-S-A-E-M-A, there is lots of different ones. But the one I've got in the studio today is called Consanguineum, and it's actually a variegated form. So those beautiful separated palmate leaves that are looking at Chloe at the moment have a beautiful silvery tinge to them, which is a little bit rarer in the trade as well.
Is this the size that the leaf gets to?
No, they can get quite a lot bigger.
Yeah.
So it can get to almost – so what we're looking at now is sort of nearly 30 centimetres across. So it can get to sort of 50, 60 centimetres across, and it creates this big umbrella. And a lot of them have sort of different foliages and things that makes them architecturally beautiful without the weird and quirky flower as well. So it brings a sense of tropical exotic to a sort of woodland garden, if that makes sense. They're cool and fun. I remember Chloe brought up some of her students, and we walked through the aracema house, and there was phones going off everywhere with photos and things. The poor little darlings had, you know, a little bit sort of dazed with camera flash.
Yeah.
It's just packed. Something, if you're into something weird and wonderful.
Yeah, it definitely is.
And slightly challenging. You know, they do need the right conditions, these beautiful, rich but well-drained and, yeah, just some great organics in there, plus, you know, perlite or gravel for drainage and things. And
foothills of the Himalayas are probably going to be pretty nutritious.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. That's where all the best stuff comes from.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I hear you say things like Himalayas quite often with the plants that you grow. So, yeah.
That's because I love those sort of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my ultimate holiday. When are we going, Larky?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, let's book one in.
Oh, my gosh. You guys on holiday would be hilarious.
Be out of control.
Yeah, we'd be. All right. Thank you, Jane. Peter, we're going to get to a couple of your plants in a second, but we do have a caller on the line. So we'll say good morning to Jan in Heathmont. How are you?
Good morning, Chloe. Good to talk to you. I have a question.
Go for it.
Well, we put in three dwarf flowering gums about 18 months ago, two red and an orange. And when we bought them, they were flowering, but they haven't flowered the last two seasons. Profusely growing, but no flowers.
They're probably just focusing on establishing their root systems without worrying. I wouldn't worry too much that they're not flowering yet, Russell.
How big are they? Just out of interest?
They're probably a metre and a half.
Yeah.
A metre.
So sometimes, and this might not be the case with you, but they're grafted onto different species. Is there any growth coming from the bottom?
No, none from the bottom.
Okay, cool.
Lots from the top.
Yeah, okay, because sometimes that grafted growth can take over and stops them from flowering, so that's good.
Yeah, it's just that I've been looking around our area and all of the miniature, the dwarf gums are flowering beautifully, and, well, the established ones, and ours aren't.
Yeah, that's interesting because they don't usually need a lot. Like they live in pretty nutrient poor soils and
sun.
How much sun do they get?
True.
Lots of sun, almost fully in the sun all day.
Okay.
As the saying goes, I've got nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I wouldn't be. I know you want flowers off it, but I wouldn't be too worried about it. They might just be focusing on establishing themselves.
Right. Mm. Yes, it could be.
It's interesting though because they are bred to be early flowers. Those things,
yes.
You know.
Yes. So not even little buds or anything on them. Just lots of green leaves.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to out you here, Jan. This is my auntie. So, Jan, have you got the watering system on them?
We do. Do you want to say hello to Zoe?
Hi, Zoe. My niece.
Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Uncle. Oh, family's here.
Beautiful.
Have you got the watering system on them?
Yeah, and they're the ones near our front gate, but I'm not worried about it.
But I am.
I just wonder if maybe they're getting a little bit too much water.
Twice a week for 10 minutes, that's all. Yeah.
That should
not
be fine.
A lot. Yeah. They look so healthy. That's the only thing. They look so good.
Yeah, if they look healthy, that's probably all right.
We might outsource this one to Chloe, I reckon.
Yeah, definitely.
I think I've got a bit of work to do.
Chloe, next time I have you over for dinner, you'll have to just check them out.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you very much.
It does keep feel like a site updated. Visit. For
yeah,
sure.
Definitely site visit and a few biscuits as well. Yeah. All right, thanks for calling, Jen.
I won't worry. Okay, Alrighty. Have a good morning.
Bye.
Bye.
I've got good family, guys.
Amazing.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're awesome. All right, we're here for another couple of minutes. Text messages come in saying that apparently the huge plant fair in Penrith, which you've been to, mm-hmm. Jane,
yep.
has been postponed or cancelled, and it's usually held in April.
Yeah, that's usually the 18th, well, around the 18th and 19th of April. It used to be the one that started up in the Blue Mountains at Bilpin, then it went to Clarendon, and then they moved it to Penrith because bigger showgrounds and because it got to the stage where it's quite huge.
Right.
And yes, so that's been actually cancelled for this season, and they will be back in 2027 with flying colours.
Okay, good to know.
So, and that's just due to the size of these events and trying to get insurances and even corporate support, that kind of thing, because of the cost of putting them on. And I think, you know, people get a bit of burnout too. Mm. Because it's all basically almost a volunteer thing to put this stuff together. So I think they just need a bit of a chill.
That's fine. And a similar scenario with Clive and Die Larkin plant fair that they have at Yarra Valley. So that's not on this year.
But they'll be back with the Chili Festival and they'll be back with the spring one in November.
Their autumn show will be back on next year as well. Yeah, beautiful. Mm. Peter, we've got a few more minutes left. Do you want to talk about one of the plants that you brought in?
I will. So, as you can all see,
yes,
this is Bipleurum fruticosum, which is a sub shrub, I guess you'd call it, from the Canary Islands.
Oh,
So it's in the Apiaceae family. So it's got a flower head like celery or carrots or yellow flowers. Foliage looks a bit like
euphorbia.
Yeah, euphorbia-ish, but greener, not unlike bay leaves, I think.
Mm. Yep.
The thing grows about, or in my garden, it's about 1.2, 1.3 metres tall as a sort of a dome, about the same across. And it's incredibly tough.
Mm.
So it does this glossy green leaves, yellow flowers, with wind-tolerant, drought-tolerant, cold tolerant, heat tolerant. So it's a really, really good plant. I've got it mixed in a planting which has got lots of local Danthonia, wallaby grass. So you've got this nice contrast between the blonde seed heads and this green and yellow.
Yeah, beautiful. It's a really vibrant yellow.
It's a terrific, terrific plant. Yeah, the whole thing at the moment is this dome of these yellow umbelliferae flower heads. It's a winner.
Yeah.
I was given this by a friend of mine in the nursery business, but it's not commonly in cultivation.
Yep.
But it's getting a bit of traction. I've seen it in posts on Instagram from gardeners around Australia and California.
Yeah, okay.
So it's starting to get a bit of sort of enthusiasm for it. But
can you say the name of it again?
So it's Bupleurum.
Bupleurum.
Bupleurum fruticosum.
Bupleurum fruticosum.
And do you have to print it at all? And you can,
yeah, I just whack it back a bit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great, easy.
You could probably take it back to the ground if you wanted.
Ticks all the boxes.
Ticks all the boxes. No, it's great. It's a great thing. It's one yet another one of these things that you think, yeah, well, why isn't this in the trade?
Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what I love about things that are so tolerant of drought? Like if they still look green.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, absolutely.
And lush. Yeah.
It doesn't look stressed at all, and it's been sitting here on the table.
Yeah, I picked it last night, so it's been hanging around for a while. So yeah.
Great cut flower as well.
Yeah, we need to be seeing more of these plants in the nursery trade.
Yeah.
Going by what's happening with, you know, our weather systems at the moment.
Look, Michael McCoy, who some of you might know of, wrote a piece quite a few years ago talking about drought-tolerant gardens and these sorts of things. It made the point in that there's any number of drought-tolerant plants around, but you do need at least some that go on giving in that later part of the year.
Yeah.
I live in Kyneton, which is daffodil central. Daffodils are amazingly drought-tolerant plants, but there's nothing there for 9 months of the year.
No value in summer.
So this is a winner in that respect.
Yeah, definitely.
And trying to find more of these things is fun.
Yeah. You know,
it's good. But this is a terrific plant.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, a couple of text messages. Peter, you've got some fans. Loving the banter between the team this morning. Great to hear Peter May on the radio. I remember him fondly from Burnley in the 80s.
Gosh.
Yeah.
We were talking about that. How many people do you reckon you've taught over the journey?
Well, I don't know about how many I've taught. Well, yeah. I wonder whether I've taught any of them. But the numbers, look, it's thousands.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, it's an amazing.
Kirill said he was a great lecturer, so that's.
Of course. Yeah. Kirill just wants his good grades.
Yep.
I've just jumped on the emails. A listener has messaged in saying the book we're talking about at the start is Preserving the Italian Way by Pietro Di Meo.
That's him.
Yep. For those olive recipes. Mm. And they've sent in an image of. It looks like a ficus with scale on it, and I would say that plant, the photo isn't super clear, but the ficus probably needs a bit more airflow. So move it somewhere else where it's getting a bit more light and airflow. Another listener has, we'll see how much we can get through this, has asked about mulching. Now, they say they collect their beech and chestnut leaves and put them through the mulcher each year. They live in Alinda. They've been putting it on the garden at 40 to 50 mil after adding dynamic lifter pellets. Is it too thick?
No.
Yep, not fine. Especially up in Alinda.
Yum.
I know. That rain will potentially be like, you know, washing that nutrition through. So you should be fine.
Recreating a northern hemisphere deciduous forest, basically.
Yep. Love it.
Yep. Yeah. Well done, listener.
And just quickly, when Peter mentioned Michael McCoy.
Yep.
So while we're on books and things, Michael McCoy is a very famous landscape gardener and has written a lot of books. So if people want to Google Michael McCoy books and stuff, there is a lot of dry climate stuff that he talks about and garden design and things.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jane. Well, we have come to the end of another 3CR gardening show. I would like to thank our panel, Russell Lark, Jane Tonkin and Peter May for coming in this morning, sharing the laughs and sharing your knowledge. It's been well worth getting up for. So thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Chloe.
Thank you to Chloe. Amy Downey and Pia Lefebvre in the studio keeping us in line. Daniel Jackson for doing our socials and Tom McLaren for doing our podcast too. We can't do it without the team. Have a lovely Sunday, everyone. I hope we get some rain. I really do hope that. And we'll be back again at 7:30 next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.